Welcome to our second episode of Coffee with Jim and Ken. And to refresh your memory, I'm Jim Williams, principal of Burnett Williams. Kim Robb is also an attorney with Burnett Williams. And we're bringing our combined experience here to address some of the legal issues that we hear about frequently from our clients. So the first one, we talked about damages and how we figure out what your case is worth. But let's talk about whether you have a case at all to begin with. And that is the issue of liability or fault. So in order to prevail on any tort claim in Virginia for money damages, you need to show that the defendant was at fault. But the defendant can also shift the case back to you and say, well, hold on, you were at fault too. That's what we call contributory negligence. So I think there's only three or four states left in the country, in the United States, that have the doctrine of pure contributory negligence. Most states have something called comparative negligence. Let me explain the difference. Actually, Kim, why don't you explain the difference between the two?
So when I practiced in New York, it was comparative negligence, which is a little bit of an easier standard. It's why slip and fall cases in New York are huge. And here in Virginia, they're not as huge. Comparative negligence is basically saying, okay, if you're a little bit at fault for your accident or your slip and fall, we will reduce your reward by the percentage that you are at fault. And Virginia says, not so fast. We are going to give you contrib. Contrib means if you are even 1%, tiny little iota percent, and your 1% is A, not B, but A proximate cause of your injuries, you do not recover.
That word is critical.
Yes,
the A versus B.
Yep. And I know I have been on the receiving end of a defense verdict for contributory negligence. It is a very hard uphill standard from the beginning of your case. In some cases, sadly, we'll turn away right at the beginning because we know there's no way we're going to overcome the hump of contributory negligence. It's a very harsh standard here in Virginia. It's also normally brought up if we do take the case, it's always going to be brought up at the close of our case.
Right. And it really goes to the issue of whether or not the defendant, the insurance company for the defendant, is going to pay anything. And if it does pay, it might offer reduced payout.
Yes.
Can you walk us through that process?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's a risk for both sides. We've had many cases here where there's a slip and fall case. And I always go back to when I was younger and I'd read these books called Choose Your Own Adventure. And you'd get to a page and it'd say, we'll go one way or we'll go the other. And that's where the insurance companies have an advantage here in Virginia. One of the things, let's take slip and falls. They have an avenue to say, well, this was open and obvious. A plaintiff should have seen this. There's no way anybody could have not fallen, tripped, a cone, or they'll say that the depression was too big. If that doesn't work, then they go, well, we weren't on notice of the condition.
Right.
No, so that gets into a whole different avenue. But they have a lot of things, or you were wearing shoes that you shouldn't, you were wearing stiletto heels during a snowstorm and you were running, you know, that you've contributed, your actions have at least 1% contributed. The issue is if a lot of these cases though, defendants will say, and the insurance companies will look and say, what's the risk? And there are risks in these cases. If we get over that hump of liability, the damages are usually, they are what they are. But we have the risk too, is are we even going to get there?
Right.
Is our case going to a jury?
Right.
And that it's a lot of work at the beginning of a case of whether we're going to put this risk in, because just to let any client know, it's a lot of money. And if these cases don't settle because the defense believes they have a good defense with contributory negligence, you're putting a lot of money into your case,
yep,
into your expert doctors to come testify. And there's a good chance your case is not going to be heard in front of a jury.
Exactly. It can be taken away. It's rare in Virginia because the Constitution guarantees that all cases go to a trial. But yeah, on the right set of facts, it could happen. When I was driving here this morning, I was trying to think of examples of contributory negligence. So you brought up premises, but let's talk about car accidents first, because people, you know, probably are more familiar with that scenario. But I'm driving along in my car and someone is about to run into me, and I look over at the radio and I change the channel. Is that contributory negligence?
They're going to make an argument that it is.
Yep. And all you need is just a little tiny bit, the 1% rule you talked about.
Yes. I mean, there are many lawyers that will stand up in front of a jury with a piece of paper and just rip the tiniest edge of that paper off and say, that's all we need. And the plaintiff doesn't recover. Another situation with car accidents, we call them green light cases, where an officer, a police officer will show up and both drivers are saying, I had the green light. Right. No, I had the green light. So a lot of times in those cases, there's no witness. Those are almost impossible, if not impossible cases. Yep. If there's a passenger in somebody's vehicle, there's the independent witness. And that's where you need to figure out who that witness is and what that witness is going to say.
Right.
I've had situations where I have right now stop sign. Who had the right away? Stop sign, four-way stop sign. There's another one. No, I was next to go. No, I was next to go. And sometimes you get very lucky. Cops now are wearing body cam. Yep. Witnesses stay around.
Dash cams.
Dash cams are wonderful. If you can get a dash cam for your car, get it.
Yep.
But those independent witnesses or a dash cam are the type of evidence to get us over that hump of contributory negligence, that independent witness. But sometimes without an independent witness, it's almost an impossibility because there's nobody, you know, one person saying this happened, another person saying that happened. And judge will say, I don't know. How does the judge know? There's no way they can know. So that's an impossible case.
And as a plaintiff, we have the burden of proof.
Correct.
So if, you know, you're in baseball, about a tie goes to the runner. Well, it's kind of the same thing in civil trial practice, is that if the plaintiff doesn't meet their burden of proof, then it's a tie. Judge can't decide. Well, the case is dismissed.
Right.
So now we talked about car accidents, and that's probably a little easier for people to grasp. But let's talk about premises liability example you brought up. So a premises liability case is one where you walk into a department store and you fall, say on a wet floor, for example, and they didn't warn the customers about the wet floor. They didn't put up a sign or something like that. That's one example of a premises liability case. A sidewalk, if the cement is too high up and you trip over it, that's also an example of a premises liability case. But talk about contributory negligence in that context.
What? Phones are going to be the death of cases.
Because
the biggest problem is with the contributory negligence is you're looking at
your
phone's in your hand and you're not seeing what is to be seen. And if there's a sign or a cone, or you're in a grocery store at the end of an aisle and there's, you know, a lot of times you'll see food stacked up or whatever they're selling. But if you're looking down at your phone and not paying attention, their argument's going to be made, how did you not see it? It's just that you were also doing something that could have prevented this harm from coming to you.
Yep.
So that's where you'll get an argument for contributory negligence.
Yep.
And that's hard to overcome. Again, a wet floor, and it's a pouring rainy day, and it's water right as you walk in, and I still think we can overcome that sometimes, but the argument's going to be, well, it's a rainy day. People are bringing in their umbrellas. Storm is in progress. We can't keep it.
Well, like black ice cases. Black ice case, for those who aren't familiar with black ice, that's where the you know, it's winter, obviously. There's been a snowstorm for a few days, and you know the sun comes out, melts the water, gets into the cracks in the cement, refreezes. And it's dangerous. And sometimes you can see ice, like at a ice skating rink, but black ice is ice that you can't really see. So if someone tries to argue contributory negligence in that context, you can say, well, wait a minute, that's black ice.
Right.
I couldn't see it. You as a shopkeeper wanting me to come and buy your goods, then you have a duty to make sure
it's safe.
That it's safe. And all you have to do is throw some salt out there, you know, whatever. So that's one example where a contributory negligence argument could be made, but you can overcome it.
Yes. I think there most situations, especially with premises, we will say, I think we can overcome this. There's a lot of unless you're really doing something, you're not paying attention. Like you said, you're in the car and you're looking down at your phone or you're, and that's why it's, that's a hard thing to prove though, right? A lot of times people say, well, we're going to get your phone records. Right. Okay. But phone records are difficult because you're never going to have the exact time of when the hit happened. So that's almost an impossibility.
Unless you had an atomic clock in the
background. If you have somebody, I mean, there are witnesses that, that have seen people, oh, they were on their phone. I was watching them. I was behind them. I've been watching them look at their phone the whole time. You don't know who's watching you on the road, I'll tell you. But, contrib is hard. I see it made a lot. But I will say, if you do have a slip and fall case, it's so fact specific that you definitely want to talk to an attorney, because a lot of those you can really overcome. I think in the situation of green light, stop sign, even merge cases, those are hard too. Oh no, he merged into my lane. He merged into my lane. Those are difficult. Those are extremely difficult cases. And I don't think those, you can overcome the contrib argument on those without an independent witness. Premises may be a little easier. It's a little more fact specific.
So our viewers don't lose all hope here. One way to get over contributory negligence is a doctrine of supervening cause. Can you talk about that?
Well,
both of us sipping our tea as we ponder that.
I'm trying to think of a really good example. Let's bring up the water example. Okay. So it's raining out and a store says, okay, I'm going to, they're walking. It's a little wet. We think you knew or should have known it would be wet right in there. And then we put but then they also put a rug down. Then they put the rug down wrong and you trip. And so what caused it? Was it the water or the rug?
Right.
So I'm thinking of, because that's like a bar question.
It is.
She was throwing a bar question out at me early in the morning before the coffee is consumed.
Yeah.
But that's when, they're rushing. They were looking at their phone. They should have seen the water, but then there's we put a rug down, but the rug was put down negligently. Now we get over that because you put the rug down negligently. Yeah. You know, I think that saves you.
I was trying to think, in 38 years, I don't know that
I've had a superseding
charge case. A jury with that supervening cause. It's one, like you said, a law school question, but hey, that's
I've
one
had
way.
Medical emergency.
Yeah.
I've had medical emergency where somebody actually had
heart attack or something.
Heart attack while driving. That's a little different. But I think one of the things that goes along with this jury instruction is, how though does this work with minors?
Oh, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Because it's a little different.
What's the difference if you're less than 7, less than 14, and over 14? Give us your thoughts on that.
Less than 7, you can't have negligence.
Right.
So if something happens to a child, all day long, that case is...
I think like dart out cases. You know, in a dart out case is where, you know, a little boy is playing in the neighborhood, ball goes out into the yard, a kid is naturally going to follow the ball out in the yard. He or she's not looking left and right to make sure the cars aren't coming, and boom, they get hit.
Right.
That's a whole classic case called dart out cases. If the child is less than 7...
Which is
the age of reason.
They can't read this. Yep. And yes, we all are probably saying, well, my kid can reason. Sure. But under the eyes of the law, they're saying that they are not appreciative of any sort of negligence on their part.
Right.
They are just without fault. So a child case, anyone under 7 to 14.
Talk about that.
Reasonable standard of a 7 to a 14-year-old.
Whatever that is.
A little bit more fact specific. I would say, and I would argue that a 7-year-old's reasoning of right and wrong and what to do in a situation is a little different than a 14-year-old.
Right.
I mean, that's a 7-year age difference. And, let's take a crosswalk case, for example. A 7-year-old may know, okay, you're supposed to look both ways, but they're not appreciating that someone could be speeding. They don't have that appreciation yet. Whereas maybe someone who's 13 has been in a car longer. They're sitting in the front seat with their parents. They've seen this happen.
They're pining for that driver's license.
They can't wait to drive. So they're by the time my son was 12, you're right. I'm sure your kids too. They can't wait to drive. So you start to talk about, the rules of the road all the time. So there's a little bit more of an appreciation of, I would always say, you know, be careful. People run stop signs. People speed. people aren't paying attention. They are looking at their phone. So I think somebody who's 13 is going to be held to a different, that's a little more fact specific.
That is.
So now you have to bring all those facts in front of a jury and a jury say, yeah, you know what? 13 years old should have known that wait a little longer. Yeah, you look right and left and then you started to go, but you heard a motor coming down the street.
Right.
You should have, you were trying to beat it out.
And so the evidence would be things like, well, in the talent and gifted program at 13,
right?
Are they good academically? What sort of activities are they involved in? And yeah, it's definitely facts specific. I know, you know, a lot of, for me, for example, I was immature until I was 25.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe you could make an argument one way or the other, depending. But yeah, it's tough. And then what happens when you reach the magic age of 14?
Then you're held to that reasonable standard.
Yep.
Reasonable person standard at that point. Again, this isn't about knowing what's right and wrong. Yes, most children, by the time they're 3 and 4, they know what's right and wrong. The issue is, can they appreciate negligence? Can they appreciate the risk that's to them? And I agree with you. It's why in neighborhoods, especially in the summer, I'm like, please, everyone slow down, because children do start, and it's just can be devastating.
It's insane, the speed in the neighborhood. You just don't know what's coming out from behind cars. And, you know, even if you don't do what we do for a living, then it's just reasonable to think that that's going to happen. It really is. I was wondering, too, about what happens if you have a child who has a learning disability or some sort of a mental health condition.
Again, I think that's very fact specific. I think you get into that. There's then again, of course, you would need some doctor testimony, expert testimony that they might be 14, 15, 16, 17, adults even can appreciate a risk.
Right.
I'll say anybody. That is a different standard that you're going to need causation testimony from a medical doctor.
Right. This might be a nice segue into assumption of the risk.
Ah.
So a lot of times in these cases, the defense will argue contributory negligence is a bar to any recovery and that the plaintiff assumed the risk. So you and I know that contributory negligence is an objective standard, meaning, you know, what would the reasonable person think about the scenario, whereas assumption of the risk is very subjective. Can you address the differences there and how that works?
So let's take the very basic one. You go to a ball game.
There's an
assumption of the risk that many foul balls are going to come flying. I don't like to sit in certain areas of baseball stadiums. I don't want line drive coming at my head. Yeah. That's assumption. Bats fall out of people's hands. Now you've assumed the risk. These are inherent risks that come with going to a baseball game.
Yep.
Now, if a ball player turns around and throws a bat at you, completely different story.
That's an intentional act. It's not negligence.
But assumption of the risk is difficult. What about
alcohol?
Alcohol, yes. I'll even give you driving range. How many times you're at a driving range and there's a million people wind up, golf balls going to fly.
Yeah.
They're going to also ricochet off of equipment, off of that. It's very difficult to be able to make those cases work and stick because you've assumed the risk. Now, we can get very technical and get into things like skiing and trampoline parks and stuff. We'll save that for another time. But general assumption of the risk is, you know, places like a ball game, even you go golfing with your kids. If a golf ball is hit by another golfer and hits you on the head and because they shank it, that's assumption of the risk. I mean,
my dad was hit by the head of the golf ball by a cousin of mine. So yeah.
I mean, so that's just kind of an inherent thing that can happen at
sporting activity.
Again, different from a golfer, like, I don't like this guy, I'm going to slam a golf ball into their head. That's a little different story.
Again, back to intentional.
Yeah. Also, then that's where premises comes in where, you know, is it assumption of the risk or is this something that they still did wrong? So, for example, and at these driving ranges, they have equipment that's picking up the balls and the balls ricochet off of them from another golfer. That's tough, but I would think assumption of the risk.
Oh,
right?
Some people try to hit the guy.
They purposely do it. Now, if there's a malfunction, however, in their Zamboni machine and it's spitting balls back at a golfer, I think then you have a good case.
Right.
But it is inherent that they have to be out on there to clear the golf balls, and you couldn't stop everybody because there's just no way when there's 300 people hitting balls, they're going to go. So again, these are all fact specific things. Yep. These are very fact specific. But contributory negligence, assumption of the risk, as you can see, we're throwing a lot of information, but what does it show? Don't let it bar you automatically.
Yeah.
Call us.
Give us a call.
because we're going to work through those little facts, tiny things. We're like, wait a second. You didn't tell us that. That changes everything.
One fact can change that. Has to be a relevant fact. Yeah. One fact can change everything.
Can change it all. Yeah. And maybe push this from a contrib case to, there's no contrib here on you whatsoever. So this is the superseding cause. Like I said, the rug that goes down and that was put down negligently, that caused the fall, not the water.
Let's wrap up with something that just came to mind here. The driver's right to assume ordinary care. Let's return to a car wreck case. So I'm driving along, and can I assume that another driver is not going to speed? Can I assume that a driver is not going to run through a red light? Or am I like on the edge of my seat the whole time? Well, you and I are because of what we do for a living. Yeah.
But
I
go
through intersections and I look left and right, even if it's green, because I'm afraid. But
correct. I mean, it's you do. You assume that everybody is going to be driving reasonable, but you have to be too. Like, so for example, I always say, please, my biggest thing is keep a distance between you and the car in front of you.
Three car lengths at least.
Because again, you assume that they're going to drive, but there are times where somebody's going to stop short.
Yep.
And you've got to be, and everyone's like, well, they stopped short. Right. But they maybe stopped short for a kid.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to make sure that you can also stop short. You know, that's not a defense. Oh, they stopped short, you know, and usually is not a defense. There might be way crazy circumstances, but yes, you can assume that a driver is going to. Until they don't.
Exactly.
But yes, that is a jury instruction.
Absolutely, yeah. And I was just thinking when my five kids were growing up and we talked about driving like you did with your son, you know, I always tell them, if I look at my car accident cases in my inventory, I would say 80% are rear-end collisions.
Yes.
Overwhelmingly a rear-end collision. So you have the odds in your favor if you will simply keep five car lengths away from the car in front of you.
Right.
Because if they stop on a dime, you know, some kid darts out in front of them.
They see
then you're okay.
You got anything.
And that, you know, we learned this in driver's ed in high school and when you take the DMV test. But, you know, the more distance, you need to give more distance, the faster you're going. So, because it takes more time to react.
Now, a little different if someone cuts you off.
Yeah.
That's again. So you could hit someone in the rear because they did something. They cut in front of you when they shouldn't have. Again, different story. So that's why the facts of your case are very important and why you need to speak it through. Don't, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there on Google and I know all of those law firms, we put things out, but it's on a very, I would say just summarized basis. Right. There's so much more that goes into each case. And that's why I spend a lot of time. I know you spend a lot of time when a call comes in to really go through
those details. Yeah.
The details.
Anybody, we get all the facts that we can. So I think we've covered that enough in this second episode of Coffee with Jim and Kim. Thanks for listening and stay tuned next week when we'll have another topic to address. Have a good one.